Hey there, this is Pastor Sue Lubinskas bringing you the fourth podcast in a series that addresses some of the big questions about religion, God, and Christianity. Today, it's suffering. We all know that suffering is real, it sucks, and it runs right smack into a good God. Look, Christians are always talking about how much God loves us and how good He is. So, where was He when my three-year-old was dying of cancer? If He's so good, why didn't He answer me when I asked Him to stop my pain? If God cares for this world, why does He allow things like terrorism, war, famine, and drought? He could just stop all that. He's God, right? If He's the author and ruler of creation, why all the devastating earthquakes, floods, hurricanes, and storms that kill and destroy? I don't know. If He exists, He's really not that great. Either He doesn't care what happens here, or He just likes to play games with us. So I'm not really sure He exists or that I even want Him to exist. Let's be honest here. This is tough. How do you square a good God with suffering? All of us can agree that suffering is a part of life. We all experience it sooner or later, and it's never fun. It sucks. And it comes in all kinds of forms and intensities. And let's be honest. Some folks seem to get double, triple, and even quadruple doses of it, while others seem to go through life relatively unscathed. That just adds insult to injury, especially when you factor in the observation that really bad suffering often seems to target innocent people, like children, and folks just going about their business, trying to make a life for themselves and their families. It's like they're born in the wrong place at the wrong time in life, just like that, through no fault or choice of their own, just is terrible and even unbearable, no matter what they try to do. It all seems completely arbitrary and unfair. Where's God in all of this? If He's so great and mighty, why doesn't He just stop it? Stop all of it. Or at least do something about all the people who are trapped in awful circumstances through no fault of their own. I'll be perfectly honest. I've had my days when I've shaken my fist at God and cried out, why? Why this? Why now? Why? Why? We humans have struggled with squaring a good God with suffering for forever. It's one of those things that hits us at the core. It's hit me at the core like a sucker punch. And I'm not going to pretend that I have all the answers. What I can give you is what God has given to me, what He has given to all of us, if we're willing to open our hands and receive it. What I have to offer is a framework for coming to terms with something that is inescapable for limited created beings living in a broken world. What I can tell you about is the example of how God, in flesh and bone, in the God-man Jesus, came to terms with suffering and overcame it. What I can offer is a way through it. We all suffer. We all will die. There's no escape from either. Why some people suffer more than others? I can't answer that question. Why are some prayers answered the way we want and others not? The same. I don't know. All I know is that God is good, really good. I learned this the hard way by going through suffering. All I can say is through suffering, the idea of a good God became very real in my life. All I can say is that I also know that God's ways aren't my ways. And I'm not saying this just to make an excuse for Him. What I mean is that He is God. He knows everything and everybody. He knows what He's doing when it comes to us and to His creation. Even if I can't see any rhyme or reason, even if I can't figure it out, I have to trust Him. It's in trusting Him, trusting in His unceasing goodness, even where there doesn't seem to be any obvious reason to trust Him, that He shows up in a big way. But He always shows up on His terms, not ours. I've said this before. Christianity isn't a fairy tale, and God isn't a fairy godfather waving a magic wand. Neither is Christianity a feel-good spirituality that's all about good vibes and connecting with your inner self. That stuff is worthless in the face of suffering. If you don't know this already, trust me, you will someday. You need someone much more substantial than good vibes, someone bigger than your inner self to get through suffering. You need a someone who experienced human suffering as a human, overcame it, made a way through it, and who will walk with you through yours. You need God. You need a God who will come to you smack dab in the middle of real life, in all of its complicated, ugly, and hurtful messiness and pain. A God who will take you by the hand if you let him, and suffer with you. That's what I said, suffer with you. I know what some of you may be thinking. She just pulled a sleight of hand. She's assuming that God exists and that he cares about us mere mortals, when I'm saying that the fact that suffering exists pretty much calls into question the existence of a good and loving God who even gives a hoot about us. Okay, I agree, you got me. So let's start with that. Let's start with the critique that a good God just doesn't square with suffering, which means that he either doesn't exist or he's not anything like who Christianity says he is. Here we go. Does the existing of suffering in the world, which we all agree is a reality, contradict the reality of a good and loving God? Or we could say it like this. If God is good, then he would get rid of suffering because suffering is bad. It's wrong. It's evil. Since there is suffering, a personal loving God is just a lame idea or wishful thinking, which means that he's not really real. Alternatively, if there's something called God out there, it's definitely neither personal nor loving, which pretty much negates the Christian God. So either way, for all practical purposes, the Christian God is just a pipe dream, a made-up, feel-good thing that people cling to make themselves feel better about a really sucky world. Let's start with this. If there's no God, then all we have is the physical world, atoms and molecules and physical, chemical, biological processes, stuff like that, right? There's no supernatural anything, no souls, no spirits, no God, nothing like that. Nothing that exists outside of what you see is what you get, physical reality. But here comes the kicker. If that's the case, then there is no moral standard against which to judge suffering as something wrong, bad, or evil. If all the reality there is physical reality, then suffering would simply be a feeling or a state of being created by a neurobiological impulse reacting to something in the natural environment. An unpleasant one for sure, but one that lacks any moral content. Okay, what am I talking about? It's time to be brutally honest here. Back to the basics. If there's no something called God, then the physical world is all we have, right? We've already talked about that. So in line with this thinking, there was the Big Bang, and then the mechanisms of evolution kicked in, and eventually humans evolved from some lower life form, from something like apes. So the theory goes. Note that it's a theory. So the theory goes of how the natural world and everything in it came about. Look, if there's no supernatural anything, this is what you get. There's no way around it. If this is the case, then everything, including us, is made up of chemical and biological processes. What we think, what we feel, and what we do is simply the product of amoral, not immoral, amoral neurobiological processes. These physical, chemical, and biological processes lack any kind of moral content. They're neither good or bad, wrong or right. They just are because the natural world just is. So in this scenario, any feelings of distress or suffering can only be attributed to some adaptive mechanism like natural selection that governs the natural world. All these evolutionary mechanisms are also amoral. They just happen according to the principles governing evolution. So suffering is simply a state of being, just like states of contentment or pleasure are. There's no moral differences among the three. You can't say the first is bad and the other two are good, since both are just a product of a morally blind evolutionary mechanisms. You may want to avoid the first and seek the other two, but you can't say one is morally evil and the others are good. Both just are what is. So, this becomes a real problem for those who argue that suffering means that something called a good God can't exist. Follow me here, it's important. If suffering is the product of blind evolutionary mechanisms, then like I said, it's neither good nor bad, it just is. This means that the existence of suffering doesn't disprove God. Since suffering lacks any moral content, it's neither good nor bad, and as such, doesn't contradict a good God who, if he exists, would exist outside of the physical world and above the amoral evolutionary mechanisms of the natural world. Existing outside of physical reality is exactly what makes God, God. In fact, those who use this argument that suffering negates or contradicts the existence of God pretty much hang themselves on their own argument. How so? Well, by claiming that suffering is bad or evil, they implicitly concede that suffering is more than just a state of being, more than just a product of physical processes and evolutionary mechanisms. They claim that suffering is bad, it's wrong. It's an evil that contradicts the idea of a good God. So basically, they're saying that the state of suffering does have moral content. It's an evil that a good God wouldn't tolerate if he really existed. Now, this idea of a moral standard against which something can be measured as being either good or bad can't come from the natural physical world, which, as I've already said, simply exists and lacks any moral content. Moral standards have to come from somewhere else, some supernatural or above nature reality, a reality we can call God. To insist otherwise is to say that everything is just the product of evolutionary, chemical, biological, and/or neurobiological processes. So for suffering to have any meaning as being morally wrong, bad, or evil, you have to concede that some kind of God, some kind of moral standard giver exists. Otherwise, all we have is the physical world and its morally neutral physical processes. Bare bones, you can have your cake and eat it too. Now, you might argue that, look, if something in the environment causes me to feel suffering, it's bad or evil for me. So see, suffering does have moral content because I say it does. It causes suffering for me, so it's bad, it's wrong, it's evil for me. By extension, all suffering is bad, wrong, and evil because it causes distress to someone or something at some time or another. Sounds good. But let's think about this for a minute. This argument is really no different from the one we just looked at. Essentially, the suffering is a bad because I say it is argument still assumes that there's some moral standard that exists outside of the natural physical world that people live in, against which suffering can be measured and judged as bad, wrong, and evil. What do I mean? I've already talked about why this moral standard can't come from the natural world, since physical reality is amoral, lacking any moral content. It just exists as a bunch of physical, chemical, and biological processes. So, for the personal statement that suffering is wrong, bad, evil because I say it is, to be more than wishful thinking, a pipe dream, or an imaginative fairy tale, for that statement to actually say something true about the reality we actually live in, That standard has to come from outside of the natural world, including outside of the individual. Otherwise, whatever that person says about suffering is just their own personal and fanciful version of reality. How can anyone say that suffering that occurs to someone else is bad if the standard used to make that assessment is solely based on a personal experience of an opinion about morally neutral chemical and neurobiological processes? Look, common sense tells us that personal statements about reality are true when they actually match reality. If that reality consists only of the natural physical world, then moral statements about that world can only be personal opinions about it. So why should anyone care about alleviating suffering? But common sense also tells us that most people believe that suffering is actually a bad, and that we need to work to alleviate as much of it as possible because it is a bad. Most people agree that suffering is real and not just a personal opinion about an amoral state of being. Otherwise, we wouldn't be all that concerned with doing something about it. Look, all I'm saying is that the popular, if it works for you, it's true mentality does have its pitfalls, including here. You either have to concede that what a person thinks or feels is true when it actually fits the reality that exists outside of their head, or you have to concede that we all exist in our own truth silos or versions of reality, in which case there is no actual reality outside of our own heads, our own opinions, preferences, ideas, etc. Now, that's just crazy loopy. But that's what you get if reality is all about you and what you think is true. What I'm saying is that we've got to start thinking clearly about these things if we don't want to just unthinkingly down the most popular flavor of Kool-Aid that's on offer out there. Okay, all of this is to say that if we want to talk about suffering as something bad, wrong, or evil, we have to concede that something outside of the physical world and outside of us exists. Something more than just a bunch of physical, chemical, and biological processes. We have to concede that a standard giver exists who stands above the natural world with its amoral physical processes. Basically, like it or not, the critique that suffering, because it is bad, contradicts the existence of a good God is more of an argument for the existence of God than an argument that a good God can't exist alongside the reality of suffering. Okay, I admit that what I just said is heavy, but we had to get it off the table. Because from now on in this podcast, we're going to assume that a supernatural reality called God really exists, and so does suffering, and so does the morally loaded assessment that suffering more than just sucks. Suffering is bad, it's wrong, it's evil. So we should do everything we can to alleviate it. Great. Now we can move on to the real heart of the matter. Here goes. And it goes like this. All of this philosophical, logical talk about moral standards, the natural world, and the existence of God really doesn't matter. I don't care. So God exists. So what? When it comes to real life on this planet, suffering is bad. It sucks. And truth be told, I don't know what to think of a God who lets some people live awful, short, brutal lives while others enjoy a long, pleasant retirement. I don't know what to do with a God who answers some prayers and not others. A God who says he loves us, but lets a little kid die of cancer. If he's so good, then let him prove it by fixing it, fixing all of it. Here's what I have to offer in response to this really good and pointed critique. God has fixed it, and he will fix it. He fixed it with Jesus, and he will fix it for good when Jesus returns. Truth be told, in the meantime, we have to trust this good God. Because just because we don't know why he does certain things and answers certain prayers in certain ways, doesn't mean that he doesn't have good reasons for what he does. We're human. He's God. He's good. As our brother Job learned way back in the day, back in the Old Testament times, when he lost everything, Job learned that God is merciful and just, and he does not oppress. That's who God is at his core. And he doesn't change, even when we, our circumstances, and the world we live in change. Because of who he is, his promises stand. In the meantime, while we're waiting for Jesus to return, and while we're living in this broken world, we have to learn to lean on God's character. We have to learn to lean on who he is. He is the God who came down to our level, who suffered as a human being, who made a way through it, who suffers with us, and who will bring us through it all, including death, into a new creation, free of death and tears, where perfect justice and perfect goodness will reign forever. That's a promise that stands. This needs some unpacking, so let's unpack it. I'm going to start with what I think is the crux of our perplexity about God and suffering. It goes like this. Just because we can't see why suffering exists and why God allows certain things to happen that seem to be entirely pointless, doesn't mean that they are pointless. Look, we're human. We have human brains. And just because we can't see or figure out why something happens doesn't mean that there isn't a reason for it. We don't and we can't see things how God sees them. If we could, we would be God. And last time I checked, we're not. To get at what I'm getting at, we need to look at this in the context of how things really are in the reality we live in. In God's story, parts 2 and 3, I talked about how human rebellion, the decision not to trust God but rather to trust created things, resulted in evil entering the world. The perfect peace between humanity and God, among human beings and between human beings and the rest of creation, was shattered. Violence, exploitation, and domination, the prey-predator dynamic, and all that is not good, not God, including death, became the norm on a planet that itself suffers the consequences of human rebellion. This is suffering writ large, writ into the very fabric of both the natural world and human history, writ into the reality we live in today. If you haven't seen God's Story Parts 1 through 5, I encourage you to check it out. It helps to understand what I'm talking about here. Okay, so we live in a world where good and evil exist together, where good times and times of suffering exist together. We live on a planet that continues to provide us with food and water, but it's also a planet where natural disasters occur. It's a broken world. The forces of nature are broken. The relationships among creatures is broken. We are broken. Moreover, this broken world we live in is populated by human beings, all of whom are made in the image of God, who have a free will. Made in the image of God, we have the freedom to make choices. Choices that are good, evil, or neutral, including the choice to be in a relationship with God. Whether you have chosen to follow Jesus or not, it's pretty obvious that this is our world. This is our reality. Given this reality, this world we live in, some suffering is due to disease, aging, and death, some to the natural forces of a broken planet, and some to the bad and downright evil choices that humans make. In this kind of world, bad things happen to good people. But bad things also happen to bad people. Given this, it's easy to conclude that much of the suffering we see and experience is simply random and pointless. But let's think about this for a minute. If you say that God, if he is good, would fix all that brokenness and suffering, get rid of it, then you also have to say that he's bigger and more powerful than us and our puny human brains and abilities. Look, we can't permanently fix suffering because we're not powerful enough, and we don't have a big enough perspective to fix the brokenness of this world, this reality we live in. All through history, we've tried and tried, striving to create all sorts of utopias. But let's be honest, nothing and nobody has worked, and the world is still broken. We can try to alleviate as much suffering as we can, and in some cases, we've been successful. And we should keep on trying if we agree that suffering is a moral bad. But we can't fix the brokenness of creation that underlies suffering. That brokenness is so big and so pervasive that it's way beyond our limited capabilities. All we can do is apply tourniquets and band-aids to the problem. So if we say that a good God would get rid of suffering, then what we're really saying is that he, unlike us, is fully capable of getting rid of suffering. He has tools way beyond tourniquets and bandages. That means, then, that he is way beyond us in the power, intelligence, and perspective departments. If that's true, then it's also true that he may have his reasons for allowing certain things to happen and for making certain decisions that we, with our limited brains and perspective, can't see or understand. So it's not really true or fair to say that just because we don't know why God does what he does, that he has no good reason for doing it. First, most of us can think of at least one instance in our lives when something good came out of a difficult and painful situation. Truth be told, suffering can produce resilience, endurance, a stronger character, a stronger faith, etc. While we're living in that difficult, painful, and sometimes tragic situation, it isn't always obvious what the point of it is. It's only once you come through it that you gain some perspective and discover that you've changed for the better. Point is, God often uses sufferings and the challenges of life to draw us closer to him, to be more dependent on him, and so to trust in him more deeply. Sometimes it takes years for it to become clear why God allowed these painful, tragic things to happen. Okay, wonderful, you say. But what about innocent people who die of some horrible, debilitating disease? Or who die as collateral damage in a war? Or who die in a natural disaster and the like? How does that build character? They just end up dead. Also, why do some people pray for God to intervene, and he does, and other people pray till they're blue in the face and nothing happens? The person they're praying for just suffers and dies. What gives? What's the point of all this? This gets to a second point. Why does God intervene and stop suffering sometimes and not other times? What possible reason is there for a choice that seems absolutely arbitrary to us? This is tougher to address because we're trying to get into the head of a God who sees everything at once in an eternal present moment. What am I talking about? God created everything, including time. This means that he stands outside of time. So he doesn't experience existence from a time-bound perspective like we do. We experience life as present, past, and future. Our lives are segmented by time, and we can't see or experience everything at once. And we certainly can't see the future. God, however, exists eternally. So he exists in an eternal present moment where the past, the present, and the future are all there at once. Nothing is hidden from God. Mind-blowing for sure. But this is God we're talking about. He literally sees everything at once. He knows everything and everybody and what they did, are doing, and will do. If that's not crazy enough, I'm about to add another layer of mind-blowing stuff on top of this. Hang in there and follow me. Every human being, because they're created in the image of God, has a free will. meaning we're not pre-programmed robots. Neither are we chess pieces that God just moves around on a chessboard. We make choices. Good ones, bad ones, morally neutral ones. All of these choices have consequences in the real world that we live in. Now think about this. God sees all the choices and all the consequences of those choices that every human being that ever lived on the planet makes, made, and will make, all in his present eternal moment. Because we know the end of the story, God's story, because God revealed it to us, we know that God is moving all things to the planned goal that he has for human history, including the planet and all of creation. I talked about all of this in God's story. Again, I urge you to check it out if you haven't yet. Now, to get all things to move in the direction that he has planned, God has to and does take into account every single human choice made throughout all of history from the beginning of creation. Seriously, can we even begin to comprehend all the decisions God makes to make sure that all things work together for his good purposes? God's wisdom and knowledge is incomparable. We can't even begin to go there. His judgments are unsearchable. What human being can know the mind of God? All we can know as far as his big plan for creation goes is what he's told us about it through his prophets and through Jesus. And even with this, all we have is a helicopter view, because we can't possibly take in every minute detail of exactly how God is bringing everything together toward his good and perfect goal. And here's the point. This is just what we would expect from a God big enough and powerful enough to fix broken creation and eliminate suffering for good. So if we're going to demand that God stop suffering, we have to let him do it on his terms, not ours. He is God. Last I checked, we are not. He has his reasons for allowing things to happen, and we don't always know what these reasons are. So we have to trust him. This includes trusting that he did provide a remedy for the evil of suffering through Jesus, and that he will fix suffering forever when Jesus returns. Fixed it and will fix it perfectly and permanently. I think our anger and perplexity about why a good God allows suffering and seems to answer some prayers and not others stems not only from the fact that we can't see or know why God does what he does in every instance of our lives and the lives of the people we know and care about, but also from the fact that he can sometimes seem to be so aloof from the mess of both the world and of our lives. Maybe that has been your experience of God. Maybe the God you've heard about in church seems to prefer the four walls of that building to the mess of your life. The truth is that the emotional, mental, and physical pain of suffering can be so overwhelming that it drowns out everything else, including any sense of the presence of God, who, in reality, is right there in the middle of all of it. I know because I've been there. It's like you're sitting in total darkness screaming, and all there is absolute silence. But it's right there, right in the middle of darkness, silence, pain, and suffering, that trust kicks in and is given the opportunity to grow and bloom. It's right there, in the mess, in the pain, that we have to remember that God is not aloof and trust that he's not absent. He's there in the dark and the silence with us. And we know this because we know what Jesus did. Jesus suffered in the dark and the silence, and he made a way through it. And if we let him, He will take us by the hand and walk with us through our pain and suffering, all the way out to the other side. As I've said many times before, Christianity is not a fairy tale. Following Jesus is not a trip through a magic kingdom where every wish and desire is fulfilled and then some. Would we really want this? Everyone just getting what they want when they want it? What would a world like that look like anyway? I mean, how would it ultimately solve anything? Plus, there would be no reason or need to trust God. It would be a purely quid pro quo relationship. Anyway, why would we ever believe something like this is true? How would something like this jive with the actual world we live in? Come on. We have tons of fairy tales and magic kingdoms and superheroes and all sorts of spiritualities that promise an escape from a broken world. And none of them has fixed either us, our world, or even made a dent in the reality of suffering. Look, anyone who tells you that if you believe in Jesus, everything will be great and the world will be your oyster is lying. Ditto, if someone tells you that God is not answering your prayer because you don't have enough faith, and if you just had more, he would intervene. It's not that simple. The fact of the matter is that it's not all about us, and thank God it isn't. We can't fix broken creation, and that includes broken us. Escape hatches are temporary and just that, an escape from reality. Look, creation, including us, doesn't need a bandage. It and we need a complete and total overhaul. It and we need a real God big enough to do just that. God is real, and he deals with reality as it is, including evil and suffering, in a real and tangible way. He doesn't wave the magic wand or answer every prayer the way we would like him to, as if he were Santa Claus or a genie in a bottle. Nope, he does something much better, something we could never dream up. We're great at dreaming up superheroes and magic kingdoms, but this God, we could never dream up, not in a million years. Yet in hindsight, he's just what we need. This God enters right into the middle of broken creation as God in flesh and bone, as Jesus of Nazareth. He experiences everything that comes with life in a broken world and then some. He doesn't just read about it or imagine how it might be to live like a puny little mortal in a vulnerable physical body. He literally lives on the planet, walks on the earth in a vulnerable physical body, and learns all about what that is like. And he even goes way beyond that when he takes on every instance of human rebellion ever on a real and tangible cross where he dies a real and tangible death. And then when it seems like it's all over, he rises, never to die again, reversing all brokenness forever. This is no fairy tale or escapist spirituality. It's a reality that canceled evil and suffering once and for all. And because God actually and really did this, we have the sure hope that this is so. Even when life throws us a killer curveball, yes, even when life throws us a killer curveball. And yes, because he is good, God does hear every prayer. And yes, he answers every prayer. But he answers in his own time and in his own good and perfect way. Because he is God and he knows everything. Sometimes he changes our circumstances and other times he gives us the grace to live in those circumstances, no matter how bad they are. But he always hears and he always answers. How do I know this? Jesus showed us, and he's also shown me. It's here in Jesus' real-time suffering that our own suffering intersects with his. It's here that every personal story of suffering, no matter what it is, is caught up in God's story and is given meaning and purpose. Here's what I mean. I'm going to tell you a story. This story is about the end of Jesus' life on this planet, his death on the cross, and what happened when he was hanging there, dying. It's in a psalm in the Bible, and it shows us how Jesus got through his suffering, making a way for us. But before we go there, let's look at why Jesus was hanging on a Roman cross dying in the first place. Quick aside, if you haven't yet, it helps to check out God's Story, especially God's Story Part 5, and the podcast, The Cross, What's With That? Okay, so why is Jesus up there on the cross anyway? Quick review. Remember in God's Story, I talked about how God isn't cool with just telling us things through human teachers, spiritual gurus, or books or tablets descending from heaven? Nope, that's not how he does things. He's all about his relationship with creation, especially us. So, rather than staying aloof from day-to-day reality, including suffering, and rather than dealing with abstract concepts, he literally steps into human history to show us who he is, who we are, and what his intentions for creation are. The cross is a factual, historical, tangible, for all eyeballs to see display of God's love for us and his creation. Love that is just, merciful, and perfectly self-giving. Remember, I also said that Jesus, God the Son, God in flesh and bone, yet fully human, never rebelled against God the Father. On top of that, he spent his time on earth healing, caring for, and hanging out with all kinds of people and teaching them about the kingdom of God. Hardly a selfish or uncaring bone in his body, much less a tyrant or criminal. Perfectly good, the perfect example of someone who loves his neighbor as himself. He's tried as a criminal by a kangaroo court and goes to the cross, where he literally takes upon himself, in his real physical body, the ultimate consequence of human rebellion, separation from God and death. Death is a fact. We all die, and we die because of our rebellion. Jesus dies the death that rebellious humanity deserves. God's legitimate exercise of justice is placed fully, squarely, and literally on Jesus. He pays the price for us. God pays the price. Let that sink in. God doesn't just tell us about this exercise of justice as if it's some kind of abstract concept or metaphor to get us through a hard day. He literally does it in the real world, in real time, through Jesus' real death on the cross. God literally dies in place of us. I'm going to say this again because it gets to the heart of God, to the heart of who he is. God literally suffers and dies in place of us. All the suffering, including death, that we experience as broken people living in a broken world is placed squarely on Jesus' shoulders. That's mind-blowing. Every instance of suffering that ever occurred or will occur, Jesus takes on, including the worst of the worst, including yours. That's why he's on the cross. So there's Jesus, hanging naked on a Roman cross outside of Jerusalem in the first century AD, and it's nearing the end for him. And he's dying, and he quotes out loud the beginning verse of Psalm 22. It goes like this: my God, why have you forsaken me? The next two lines of the psalm go like this: why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer, by night, but I find no rest. Let these words sink in. We've all been there at some point in our lives. The cries of anguish in the dark and the total silence as mental, emotional, and physical pain drowns out everything else. Jesus is forsaken. Now, Jesus, like any Jewish male at the time, learned the Hebrew scriptures by heart. So when he spoke the opening words of Psalm 22, my God, why have you forsaken me? He more than likely had the whole thing in his head and in his heart. Now, I've already talked about how all the rebellion and suffering of broken creation was placed on Jesus' shoulders. But here's the kicker. Remember, before he came down to earth as the God-man Jesus, he was and is and will always be the Son, the second person of the Trinity. Remember, the word Trinity refers to the fact that the one God exists as three persons, God the Father, God the Son, and God the Holy Spirit. Okay, going back to Psalm 22 and Jesus' last moments on the cross. All this stuff about the Trinity and what I said about Jesus being fully human comes into play. Jesus is God, but he's also fully human. Because he is fully God, he has a unique, unbroken relationship with his Father that he maintains during all of his time on earth by resisting every temptation to rebel, to sin, by always choosing to trust God, doing all of this in the power of the Holy Spirit. He and the Father are one from before creation to his time on earth through just about the very end of his time as the God-man Jesus. Note, I just said that Jesus and the Father were uniquely close to just about the very end. What do I mean? Being executed as a criminal on a Roman cross ain't no walk in the park. It's physically brutal. But even worse for Jesus was the emotional and mental pain that came when he lost that unbroken relationship with the Father that he had always had eternally. You see, when the weight of human rebellion, human sin, and when the weight of broken creation and all the consequences of that were placed on him as he hung on the cross, that relationship was broken. It was the divorce between humanity and God writ large in Jesus' person. It was as if Jesus became us in all of our rebellion and sin against God. For Jesus, the Son, it was like being rejected and abandoned by the most important person in his life, right at the time when he needed him the most. The person he loved the most, the person closest to him, the person he would do anything for. Jesus is rejected by God, abandoned by God. His suffering must have been unbearable. So the words of the psalm come to him. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from my cries of anguish? My God, I cry out by day, but you do not answer. By night, but I find no rest. How many times have we cried out words like these? Why won't you save me, God? Why won't you save her? Why won't you save him? Where are you? Why won't you answer my prayers? Do you even hear me? Do you even care? I hurt so bad. Help me. Don't leave me like this. So like us, Jesus knows what it's like to be in a bad place, a really bad place. He's at his lowest point. Been there and done that. And I'm sure you can think of a time like that too, but it's not over. The next part of the psalm clues us in as to what Jesus does next in his last few minutes on the cross. It's similar to what he did in the last few hours before his arrest. He remembers who God is, and he deliberately makes the choice to trust. He leans on and into God's character. He remembers that God is God, and this God has already proven who he is in his relationship with Israel. This God has saved before, and he will do it again. He can be trusted. Jesus can trust him with his life, and he does. He banks on God's character in his darkest moment, even though he has lost any sense of God's presence. Read the middle part of the psalm for yourself and see. The kicker line is verse 24, and it goes like this. For he, God, has not despised or scorned the suffering of the afflicted one, Jesus. He, God, has not hidden his face from him, Jesus, but has listened to his cry for help. Really? God listened to Jesus' cry for help? He didn't come flying off that cross. I thought Jesus died. Yes, he did. But he died trusting and hoping. And by doing this, he made a way through suffering on both the personal and cosmic, all of reality, levels. Let's look at the personal level first. This is where my own story intersects with God's story. I was in a really bad place. This happened after I had already become a Christian. It seemed like everything was falling apart in my life, and I was tempted to numb it all, escape it all, and feed the addiction that I had kicked 3 years ago. So there was that. On top of all of this, I had run myself down physically. This was a big mistake, and I knew better, but there I was. I had run myself down, and the addiction was roaring like a lion. Things just were going bad, and I was having a crisis of faith, wondering where God had gone. I felt abandoned, sitting in the dark, screaming with no one around to hear me. It was awful. Then I heard a soft whisper telling me to read Psalm 22. I hadn't heard God's voice for some time, so I went and I read it. Now, I had read the psalm many times, and like a lot of other folks, I was most familiar with the first verse, Jesus' recorded words on the cross. My God, why have you forsaken me? Those words appear in the crucifixion scene in the Gospels of Matthew and Mark. Those words make Jesus seem pretty hopeless, exactly how I was feeling. But as I kept on reading, it suddenly dawned on me why Jesus chose that psalm. You see, Jesus never rebelled against God, not even in his worst moment as he hung on the cross, abandoned. Rather, Jesus chose to lean on God, to bank on who God is. Jesus chose to remember God's goodness and to trust, even when there was no apparent reason to trust. Though he was completely rejected and abandoned, Jesus chose to cling to the one who had abandoned him. Let me emphasize this. Jesus was literally rejected by the Father when he took on human rebellion and sin. Jesus suffered all the consequences of the divorce between God and humanity, though he himself never asked for a divorce. The man who never experienced a wall between himself and his Father was rejected by the very person he loved most. Not because of anything he did, but solely for our sake. Look, Jesus knows suffering. He knows all about it and then some. He knows what we go through and then some. He's been there and done that, literally. Look, unlike Jesus, when we suffer, we're not rejected by God. God is with us in our suffering, even if we feel like he's not there. It's like our suffering is swallowed up by Jesus' suffering, which did include being abandoned and rejected by God. Jesus' suffering is like a force of nature, a tornado that sucks everything up. Don't get me wrong, our suffering is real and it really sucks, but it's not too big or too much for Jesus. He's been through the absolute worst of it. He was rejected and abandoned by God. He can handle anything. When we suffer, Jesus takes us by the hand and suffers with us, if we let him. If we hold on to him, remember who he is, and trust that he will get us through it. And this is exactly what happened to me. After reading through the psalm, I gave everything over to Jesus. I placed a whole mess in his hands, took his hand, and marched forward. My circumstances didn't change. Things were bad for a long time. What changed were my feelings of hopelessness and aloneness. In the middle of the mess and temptation to trust in the bottle, There was a sense of peace and strength that I can't even begin to explain or describe. All I know is that I took a long, cool drink of grace that day. I didn't give in to the temptation to trust in the bottle and feed the addiction. It wasn't easy, but I got through it. That was over 20 years ago, and I've been sober since. And no, it wasn't always easy, but the grace was always there. So, on the personal level, yes, we suffer. Yes, we die. But we don't have to do it alone, and we don't have to do it in our own power. There's one who is bigger than us, more powerful than us, who will walk through the fire with us, and we'll walk in his power, which is a power big enough to conquer suffering and death forever. This takes us to the second level I mentioned, the cosmic or whole universe, all of reality level. Jesus not only made a way through suffering for each one of us, he also made a way to reverse and set right all suffering, and I mean all, forever. What am I talking about? Back to Psalm 22. This is how the story ends, both when Jesus was hanging on the cross dying and when he will return at the end of history. Let me read the concluding verses of the psalm. Listen up. It's beautiful. It's God. It's hope. Here we go. The poor will eat and be satisfied. Those who seek the Lord will praise him. May your hearts live forever. All the ends of the earth will remember and turn to the Lord, and all the families of the nations will bow down before him, for dominion belongs to the Lord, and he rules over the nations. All the rich of the earth will feast and worship. All who go down to the dust will kneel before him, those who cannot keep themselves alive. Posterity will serve him. Future generations will be told about the Lord. They will proclaim his righteousness, declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. Declaring to a people yet unborn, he has done it. Jesus banked on this promise over 2,000 years ago, and we stand as the beneficiaries of his self-giving sacrifice. He gave up his life and his unique relationship with the Father for us. We are the people yet unborn mentioned in the psalm, whom Jesus was thinking of as he took his final breath. Abandoned and rejected, he died in hope, standing in the certainty of that promise. And he didn't just change the course of history at a particular time for a particular group of people. He changed the entire universe. The cross is more than a symbolic memorial to a dead hero. It had, has, and will have power, real power, to transform all of creation. Jesus' death unleashed a river of grace that is already flowing and will flow into every broken and dead thing. Grace with the power to restore and to transform all of creation, rewrite every story, right every wrong, bring humanity and all of creation back into a life-giving relationship with God. How so? 3 days after Jesus died, the last line of Psalm 22 is fulfilled. He has done it. Jesus is raised from the dead, never to die again, never to be apart from the Father again. He rises and then returns to his Father, where he reigns as Lord over all things. Which means that when he returns, not only will all suffering end, but everything, and I mean everything, will be made right. Every wrong will be made right. All suffering will be made right. Because he, Jesus, has done it, we have hope, even in the worst of times. We have the sure promise that Jesus will walk with us in the worst of times and that we will walk not in our own power, but in his. And even better, we have the certain promise that when he returns, he will wipe away each and every tear. There will be no more death or mourning or crying or pain, for the old world will have passed away and the new will have come. And God himself will be with us. No wall, no divorce, no sense of abandonment or rejection ever. Look, you don't need to face pain and suffering alone. Turn to Jesus and he will turn to you. Tell him you're thirsty and he will freely give you a long cold drink from the spring of the water of life. Tell him that you want to come home and he will make you his child. Tell him that you're tired of the dark and the silence and he will be your light and your song. He will make a way for you right now and forever. Come.